Blog Talk Radio.
Research at the National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. I want to welcome our callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. Well, tonight's topic is a discussion on education during Reconstruction in Lafayette, Louisiana, Walter H. Williams, a man who made a difference. Now, I have a question for some of you genealogists. How many of you have noticed, let's say in the 1870 or 1880 census, that your relatives were listed as attending school? Have you ever wondered who taught them? Have you ever wondered why they were attending school? Well, you know, I looked at a quote by W.E.B. Du Bois, and in that quote he says, "Of all the civil rights that the world has struggled and fought for 5,000 years, the right to learn is undoubtedly the most fundamental." Now, I can recall hearing my mother share stories of how her grandmother, who was born in 1879, was always talking about getting an education and taking classes in New Orleans. My mother even had a picture of her grandmother surrounded by students in her Sunday school class because she was a Sunday school teacher at a church called Greater King Solomon Baptist Church in New Orleans. You see, for her, education was the foundation of freedom, the type of freedom so many freed men and women hoped for during Reconstruction. Well, I am really happy to have Beverly Babin Woods on Research at the National Archives and Beyond tonight. Beverly is a genealogist, writer, and lecturer with her ancestral roots in Louisiana. Her research at the National Archives and to the Freedmen's Bureau Educational Records has been well documented on education of African Americans during Reconstruction in Lafayette, Louisiana. Beverly is also featured in the National Archives signature film, Democracy Starts Here, describing the mission of the National Archives. She's a member of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society and also is a part of the Prince George's Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society. She is a presenter, and she has presented at many genealogy conferences, local schools, private organizations on poetry, writing, and genealogy. So let me give a warm welcome to my guest, Beverly Babin Woods. Beverly, how are you?
I'm fine, Bernice. How nice to talk to you tonight. And thank
you so much for the invitation. Well, thank you so much for joining the show. Beverly, how did you get interested in genealogy?
Well, I must say that genealogy became a part of my life in about 1973. And my interest really formed as a young woman, maybe about 16 to 17 years old, but I never pursued any of the information that was on my mind. I wanted to know, after traveling abroad and talking to so many people who couldn't understand the races in the African-American community in America, and I began to try to explain, but I looked like some of the same people I was talking to. So there was something in my mind that said, you know, I've got to find out why, who I am, where did this come from? And then later in my life, my father had always talked about his grandfather was a school teacher in Lafayette, but never anymore. He didn't know much more than that. So after I moved to Washington, D.C. in about 1967, my dad said, well, since you live there now, why don't you pursue the interest you have in your great-grandfather and do some research at the National Archives? Well, that went right over my head for a while. And then in 1973, I decided to visit the National Archives and start my research. And it was a good idea. The National Archives was the greatest thing that had ever happened. When I walked in, the consultants were so friendly and so open to try to help with the little information that I had at that time, which was simply that my great-grandfather was a school teacher in Lafayette. Mm-hmm. So they directed me to the census records first. That was the beginning.
Yes. So you had this piece of oral history, this statement from your father that his grandfather was an educator.
Yes.
And that was it.
Okay. That was it for me, yes. For our family, that's all that we knew at that time. That's all that I knew at that age, as an adult, actually. But I do remember my father talking a lot about his grandfather, but that's all he really talked about. His mother was deceased, but he always talked about how smart this family was. Okay.
Okay.
So that's what got me started, and the interest prevailed.
Mm-hmm. Now, where was your grandfather from? Did you have any information?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I didn't. He did tell me, Bernice, that my grandfather was from Canada, but we didn't know any more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did I find out the rest? Well, to be brief, when I went into the 1870 census, and the reason I went into the 1870 census was because thinking in terms of what was going on in America, in Louisiana or in the South during that period, I picked the year that was closest to Reconstruction.
Okay.
My great-grandfather first appeared in the census records in 1870. As a 23-year-old school teacher from Canada. That's the only thing that the 1870 census said.
Mm-hmm.
From that point, well, that was a starting point. The next, so 10 years later, I went in again, and in 1880, he had married Jean-Pierre Doucette, and they had children. My grandmother, my father's mother, Agnes Williams, was born in 1883. She was the youngest of the family.
Mm-hmm.
There were six brothers and sisters, six brothers and I think there are two sisters. But anyway, the focus tonight will be on Agnes and her father. And so 10 years later, I went back into the records, and in 10 years he had children, he had a housekeeper, and he had a brother living in the household, The brother's name was Moses B. Williams, and he was also from Canada. In fact, he was born in 1838 in London, Ontario, Canada. Mm-hmm. Walter was born in 1844 in London, Ontario, Canada.
Now, did it say anything about the parents?
Not in 1870, but in 1880, there was a column asking, where were your parents born?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I discovered that my great-great-grandparents were from Virginia.
Okay.
Their names were Reason and Miranda. Now, the census record did not tell me their names. The names of my great-great-grandparents came later.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, oral history told me that Walter, the person the story is in reference to, Walter was married to an Irish woman, and they had been married in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to Canada in the 1830s. Now, I discovered that they went to Canada in the 1830s because I discovered the birth dates of Moses Williams, which was the older brother. And he was born in 1838 in London, Ontario, Canada. And then my great-grandfather, Walter, came later in 1844.
So as far as you know, Walter was educated in Canada as a school teacher.
Walter was educated when he came to the United States. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He spoke fluent French,
mm-hmm.
and his handwriting was impeccable because he wrote many letters to President Benjamin Harrison later. And his school reports, I have copies of his school reports and of documents that he had to write and sign. And his penmanship was impeccable. His speech, his spelling, everything was truly that of an educated man.
Now, Beverly, please share with us. Now, you went to the National Archives and you went through the census records. So you identified everything about Walter Williams as far as where he was born and when he was born.
Yes.
But how did you determine that the Freedmen's Bureau hired him? Share with us just what was in the Freedmen's Bureau records.
Okay. I was referred to the Freedmen's Bureau records by an archivist. When I mentioned the word school teacher, he said, there's a good point for you to start. And he sent me to the Freedmen's Bureau records, at which time I had to identify the specific area of Louisiana, which was Lafayette Vermilion Parish, which encompassed about five or six towns in and around Vermilion Parish, including Lafayette. And that was the territory. When I went into the Reconstruction records under the Freedmen's Act, Freedmen's Bureau, there was a specific records education. Most of the records are for military, medical, pension. Education was probably the smallest record in the Freedmen's Bureau records.
Mm-hmm.
And as many people know, the Freedmen's Bureau was established on March 3rd, 1865, under an act by the U.S. Congress to establish a relief for the formerly enslaved people.
Mm-hmm.
So, however, one of the shocking things to me was that it ended in 1872, which was surely not enough time to educate and do justice to all of the formerly enslaved people. Another discovery within the Freedmen's records and some of the records that my great-grandfather that were held in the archives indicated that the people did not have transportation nor money to come to the school in many cases. They couldn't come at night because they were afraid to come out at night.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go back in history mentally to realize and to understand how things were then. after the Civil War and after during that period. People were afraid. They had places to go, but they had to get there.
Mm-hmm.
They had to understand how to get there and when to get there. But one of the things I discovered in the Bureau of Records was one of the many documents was a letter from the Superintendent of Education for the Bureau, for the Bureau, Freedmen's Bureau. And he says, Walter was the first Freedmen's Educator employed by the Freedmen's Bureau in Lafayette Parish. In a letter dated February 3, 1868, Frank Chase, the Superintendent of Education in the state of Louisiana, notified Walter Williams that, here I quote the letter, "You are hereby appointed to teach the Freedmen's Schools of Louisiana. You will proceed to Vermilion Lafayette Parish, Louisiana, and report to O. A. Rice," which was Oscar Rice, assistant superintendent and commissioner, "for assignment to duty in his parish at a salary of $50 per month, provided that amount can be collected from the freedmen by the sale of tuition tickets." Yes, or fines. "Transportation will be provided or refunded by the Bureau," which indicated to me that these poor people had to pay to come to the freedmen's schools. Now, the school was held, his classes were held in a school, in a church that was provided by an organization, an African-American, as we say today, organization that had established a church and gave and let Walter Williams use that church to hold the classes. I also discovered through the census records in 1880 when his brother, Moses, who was also a school teacher, quite a bit older than Walter, came in. The two brothers ran two schools as time moved on. One was the Williams School and the Excelsior School. Also, on November 19, 1868, the commissioner of the Bureau wrote, "I have the honor to report the arrival at this station of Walter H. Williams, parenthesis colored, with a commission from your office as a teacher of colored schools and with orders to report to me for assignment to duty. I also return here with vouchers for his stage transportation from New Iberia to this place in the amount which he desires remitted to me." And the letter goes on. And I've got about 10 letters that substantiate all of the things that were going on during that period, as well as reports, school reports.
Now, Beverly, mm-hmm. how long did it take you, I mean, to go through the Freedmen Bureau records to find those letters? And I want to know even more about what you found, what you discovered in the education records.
Well, the process is very lengthy. But the at that time, and I'm sure that the National Archives still offers this service. When you go to the National Archives and you want to research documents, actual documents, there's a procedure for allowing you to go into those directly. The documents will be brought to you. There's a book, and unfortunately, I don't have the name of the record books that you go through to find the record. But you go through a period of records that pertain to that particular state, that particular parish, that particular school district, and under whose auspices it's under. You go to those records. They're there. They're on file. You can't miss them when you know what you're looking for, and it specifically tells you as you search where you're going.
So, Beverly, are you saying that you went to original records as opposed, I mean, you were actually
yes.
able to touch the documents as opposed
absolutely.
To microfilm?
No, not microfilm.
Okay.
Not once have I used microfilm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I went directly to the documents. and they bring you the document. They, at that time, and I have to speak specifically, I started working on this project between 1973 and 1976 sporadically. I joined the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society in 1995. I had already been working with the National Archives, pardon me, Records and Beyond since the 70s. So, excuse me. Therefore, when I want to finish this so that the audience can understand that when you search the records, when you go to the Freedmen's Records or any records within the National Archives, they will bring the records to you. You request them on a form. They will put them on a tray and bring them to you within so many hours of the day or week. You can go through each box, each record. It takes time, it takes energy, and it takes a lot of Xeroxing. Now, for researchers, it may be a bit easier because it's on the internet. It's on Ancestry.com or other sites that provide such services. However, it is known that Ancestry.com probably has the largest service and the lengthiest service. But, yes, all of my documents within the Freedmen's Bureau were from the direct records.
Now, can you give us some idea of what unique information did you find in the Louisiana education system during Reconstruction regarding the education of former enslaved citizens that many of us may not be familiar with?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I can briefly tell you my memory, and then I can read a couple of documents for you to let you know. Okay. Specifically, there was no education for black people. There probably were some private education going on in homes for perhaps free people or people of color. But there was no instrument of education for those just coming off of the plantations or not educated. And this is where the Freedmen's Bureau, which probably was not necessarily respected by these citizens, white citizens, because it was a federal program, and it was integrated. But according to my grandfather's records, which he had to report monthly to the superintendent, they didn't have any white kids attending these schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very difficult for black students to get there. And the original thought process in the establishment was that blacks didn't want to be educated,
mm-hmm.
which was totally wrong. And I can read to you something here, the two things I'd like to share with you. One is, the school, the building spoken of by Mr. Lenderman as a school home is altogether too small and dilapidated to serve the purpose. It being only intended, and these are direct words, okay, it being only intended as a kitchen or cookroom for the dwelling in the same yard, I have secured a building owned. The freed people are manifesting an increased interest in the subject of education. And at this point, I'd like to say that prior to this report, the superintendent's report said that they showed no interest in education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A school was opened in this town today, and a night school in connection with the same will be started immediately. There is now a fair prospect of a good attendance at both the day and night school. Mr. Williams, who has just reported to me with a commission as teacher of freedmen from the General Superintendent of Education in New Orleans, is in charge of the above-mentioned school. There are not many unemployed freedmen who are able to work now in this parish, and there is plenty of work for all of them to do as labor is in demand. But many freedmen are not included to contract, are dissatisfied, and undetermined as to whom they shall work for, which causes much complaints from the planters. So although the people were offered the plantations, and many of them considered free, there still was no place for them to work.
Mm-hmm. Still no place to work, yet that desire to be educated
was there.
Was very strong.
It
was
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I wish the children of today could step back to understand what the freedmen went through.
Correct.
To be educated, because
right.
you can't give, don't give up that freedom by not wanting to be educated.
That's right.
And what you're saying, that he wrote, the desire was there.
That's right. And that was from the superintendent of education. After they realized that this person who came to town, oral history from the family. Now, my dad did tell me this, that his mother told him, when her father came into town on the train, on the stage, whatever way he came, the black people had a band there to greet him.
Isn't that something?
And in the report, it also states, I have not as yet had any applications from planters colored, which will accommodate from 60 to 80 pupils at a monthly rent of, listen, $10. $10 to go to school.
$10.
The building has been used as a club room by the Loyal League. Now, the Loyal League was obviously a black organization that had been, and they are the ones who were obliged to give the club permission to meet on Saturdays and Sundays, which will not interfere with the school. So, therefore, this club allowed the school to be held during the week.
Mm-hmm.
And it was stated that this is the only building in town, we're talking about in Lafayette, at all suitable for a school which could be secured.
Isn't that something?
Now, one of the things that was of interest to me, and I think you asked me this earlier, I'm not sure, but is what education was there. Now, the Jesuits were in the area, but they didn't open schools for coloreds until 1903, if my memory doesn't fail me.
Mm-hmm.
So up until then, there was the public schools that came into action later, which was established and pushed for by a man by the name of Paul Breaux, who actually took the focus off of my great-grandfather, because Paul Breaux was responsible for public education.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, Walter Williams may have been even considered a carpetbagger, but because he was out from Canada coming to Louisiana to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why? Why did he end up in Louisiana? My theory through research is that, pardon me, he possibly came into Louisiana because that's where they needed him, and
mm-hmm.
because of his speaking French. Most of the people in Louisiana at that time spoke French, and he was fluent in French.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the people coming off of the plantations were bilingual. So that was one of the reasons that he probably was sent. Now, my theory also is that when he came into the United States, he first appeared on the census records in 1870 in Louisiana, but there's a strong possibility he may have stopped here in Washington, D.C., through the African Colonization Society, which was spearheading programs to put people of color in different strategic parts of the country and the world, primarily Liberia, but other parts of the country as well.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was a reference, there was an education division of that organization, and in some of the writings from my great-grandfather, there was a reference to a Reverend R. L. Perry, which was a reference also made to by a Perry at the organization, at the major organization that I just spoke of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So his pupils were 25 from Royville, 30 from Abbeville, And let's see if I can be more specific.
Well, Beverly, while you're looking at where they, they came from, did they actually have the names of the students, or they just had the numbers
no,
and where
they
came from?
No, it was
from?
All by numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It was all by numbers. And among the parents, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I don't want to cut you if you have a question.
Oh, no, 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 no. I'm listening.
Okay. Among the parents, he mentions, Walter does. I'm using all my efforts, but in consequence of the excitement of the time, my efforts are great futile. The freed people are too completely terrified to attempt any movement for their own progress at present.
Mm-hmm.
The question being, what efforts are you making to secure the support of schools by pupils, parents, boards of education, or the state? The next question he was asked was, what is the public sentiment as to the education of the freedmen and poor whites? The response is indifference on the part of whites, with their influence rather against than for it, while the sentiment of the colored people is generally in favor of education, though there is a general feeling among them that their schools ought to be free. The impression is general among that of the free schools which will be opened. And that is because there was a cost to go to school.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. But once again, you're saying that that desire was so strong.
Absolutely.
For education that they were willing to pay, although they wanted it to be free, they still were willing to pay. And can you imagine what the families went through and what kind of sacrifice they endured just to make sure that they had a child or that they were able to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I bring it back to today and say, why can't the kids today understand
mm-hmm.
what was going on, you know, that fight for freedom?
Mm-hmm.
That's so strong.
Because
and that desire for education was so strong.
Mm-hmm. Bernice, I think that one of the major problems is that the history of how our people arrived and in education in the United States is not known. The details, there are books written, many books, but little is known about ordinary people who made extraordinary differences in trying to educate African American children and the pride that was taken during that period and up to now for people to educate their children in a direction mm-hmm. that can promote them to be successful in a free society.
Mm-hmm. Well, Beverly, let me have you hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Beverly Babin Woods. Well, Beverly, let's continue to talk about this, and I'd like to open the lines. If any of you would like to ask a question, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. If you have any questions for Beverly, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host.
While we're waiting, Bernice, can I make a comment?
Absolutely.
Well, one of the things I want to put forth to the audience is, although oral history is important, history that cannot be proven can be the brick wall. In the field of genealogy, there are many channels to break through and gain access to information we are looking for. It depends on how we start and where we search. Mm-hmm. The only information I personally had on, and I went on to say, on Walter Williams. The other point I wanted to make is, again, in my book, despite the many hardships, Walter Williams and his brother Moses, also a teacher, had many successes. The register of the school offices and terms of office for the 3rd Division of the Freedmen's Bureau listed Walter H. Williams as president on the 18th of March, 1871, through April, 1873. The report indicates that Walter and Moses had the largest attendance records in 12 wards: Olive, Washington, Live Oak, Excelsior, Rank, La Brea, Cunningham, Doucette, Hopkins, Chagua, Malecon, Malmaison, and Melqua parish, areas of Vermilion
mm-hmm.
Parish.
Mm-hmm.
On June 14, 1873, Walter Williams was appointed to the public school board in the parish of Lafayette. Walter and his brother Moses were appointed as school teachers by the board on 11 August 1873 in the parish of Lafayette in Vermilionville. Thus, Walter and his brother successfully bridged the worlds of federal and local government-supported education.
That's wonderful. Now, that's wonderful. Now, there's a question coming out of the chat.
Okay.
And it's basically a statement, but they said, you know, in South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
the Reconstruction General Assembly established free public education.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, was there not a similar movement in Louisiana?
I can't speak for the state itself. There is a reference to a free education, but my focus was not, there wasn't much in my research that led me to free education. There really wasn't, not at that time, not between 1868 and 1872, perhaps later. But also I would like to say that since 1868 was determined the first by the Freedmen's Bureau to have education, there were other southern states that may have started sooner, which is not would not have been unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Louisiana was behind.
Yes. Now, in New Orleans, I mean, they did have the schools. The free people of color had the schools in New Orleans.
Yes.
But after the American Civil War,
mm-hmm.
you still had discourse in which
Absolutely.
in which the whites did not want to attend school with the freedmen, simply because they felt that the freedmen were not prepared intellectually to be in a classroom with them. So the fight began very early. They wanted the separate. They did not want them integrated attending schools
mm-hmm,
at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It appeared that they didn't want equal. And
they wanted it separate.
They did not want equal. They wanted
mm-hmm.
separate. What we must remember is the whites who were going to school or who were being asked to go to school with blacks weren't in much better shape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We're not talking intellect here. We're talking lifestyles. Unfortunately, they were probably sharecroppers as well.
Yes.
Because they had schools to go to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was only poor whites who were included in this program, this federal program.
Right.
So what I found myself doing as I researched over the years is putting myself in that time frame.
Yes.
Because I realized at some point that there was no way for me to be in both in both areas. I either had to put aside where I am now and go to what it was like then, because I'd find myself comparing or making references that could not really hold water because the time frame was so different and so was the system.
Yes. But, you know, Beverly, when you think about education, and even before the American Civil War, even when our people were still enslaved, they still wanted to learn how to read.
I don't think there's
and
any
they
question.
And they were forbidden. They were absolutely forbidden to learn how to read, how to write. I mean, you saw them putting X's instead of spelling their name.
Well, here's, Bernice, I hate to cut you off, but that is...
You're not cutting me off. That's okay.
that was definitely the way it was. And the key to that was that here was a free, when I say free, I mean mentally free, okay? Here was a free man coming in to work with people who had never been free.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, we're not talking about the free people of color who were getting an education in New Orleans, who were being taught maybe in private homes by private teachers, by private school teachers. And there are names of those teachers in some of the records. Many of them were not Freedmen's Bureau teachers. They were educated free people who were teaching free passe blanc. So here we are talking about people who had never been educated. It was against the law for a free person to teach an enslaved person anything,
That's right.
to read. So when this man came into town to educate people, this was something totally new. And I'm going to read this to you real quickly. In 1880, there were 6 Negro schools in the parish. Now, mind you, this is, what, almost 20 years later?
Yes.
Okay. By 1885, Walt H. Williams and Baptiste Pirro were teaching 150 students in the Excelsior School. Now, this is one of the schools that Walter and his brother owned. In 1887, the Negroes of Royville petitioned the school board to employ, here we go, Paul Breaux to teach there. But there is no record of his employment. In 1900, there were 206 Negroes enrolled in the public schools. And in 1922, there were 10 colored teachers in the parish. Now, this is 1922. He further stated that Negroes organized private schools for their children in various parts of the parish. Keep in mind, this was later. Such schools were conducted in Lafayette, Dusson, Ridge, Youngsville, and in a few other communities. Some of the leaders in the founding of these schools were Akil Figaro, Walter H. Williams, Louis Anderson, Alice May. Alice Mayne, M-A-Y-N-E, was also mentioned a lot in the Bureau records. She was a teacher during that period, too. And Paul Breaux. But they came later, if you notice. They came in the 1880s. Around 1885, the private school in which Walter Williams taught in the Good Hope Baptist Church was taken over and financed by the parish. Here's an interesting point for me. In 1903, the first Catholic school for Negroes was established in Lafayette by the Sisters of the Holy Family. This was the beginning of Catholic education for Negroes in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Isn't that interesting? You have some excellent documentation.
It's all documented. And it's later he went on to work in 1886. He was appointed as an assistant U.S. weigher at the United States Customs House at the Port of New Orleans. And on 17th of August, 1889, he wrote a letter to President Benjamin Harrison, of which I have the letter, with a petition from the citizens of Lafayette attached, requesting to be considered for a position of assistant appraiser with the U.S. Customs. The petition included, signed by T. Pattis of the 3rd Congressional District Committee. He was extremely involved in politics as a Republican, getting people to vote, black people to vote. Walter wrote a letter to the president. I'll read the letter he wrote to President Benjamin Harrison requesting a meeting. "Sir, I visited your city," meaning he came to Washington, D.C., about 10 days ago with the expectation of having a short interview with you in regard to my application for assistant appraiser at the Port of New Orleans. But as you were away, I failed my purpose. I wish to say to you that my record, both politically and officially, is good, which the signatures appended to my petition will attest of the former, and my standing as U.S. Assistant Weyer for over 3 years under Secretary Arthur's administration, I presume, can be obtained in the Treasury Department, as I am informed that the records of all officials who have been employed by the government is kept there. On last April, I passed the civil service examination for Assistant Weyer, reaching a score of 93% and the first on the list. This is sufficient test of my ability. And the letter goes on. I cannot find a record that he ever received the position, but I do have a copy of his civil service record and his
and
civil
when
service
was this?
Test
what score. Time was this, Beverly?
This was 1885. Yeah, this was 1889. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Now he seems to have been able to move throughout Louisiana through the government to write letters to the president. What kind of barriers did he experience as a educator trying to make a difference in Lafayette?
Well, I found records indicating that he had a house, a place in New Orleans where he would go to hide or live or stay, mm-hmm. At 199 Dumaine Street, mm-hmm. in the French Quarter, because the regulators were constantly after him. And I might add that, unfortunately, in 1902, Walter Williams was murdered. And
that
that's
is.
As much as I would say, I will say about that. And I do have documentation on that as well. And on October 5th, 1889, he wrote a letter on behalf, I'm sorry, a letter was written on his behalf. To President, by Frank Senegal, a local member of the Louisiana State Committee and president of the 15th Ward Republican Party. And the letters go on and on and on. His personal life, I've told most of it, but he had, his children were seven, Walter Jr., Reason, Alice, Arnetta, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, Agnes, which is my grandmother, and Wilson. He was murdered at the age of 54.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to answer any questions if there are any. Otherwise, I'll go on.
We don't have any questions coming out of the chat. There is a comment out of the chat, though,
okay.
that states that in 1874, according to Eric Fauner's Reconstruction, there were several thousand black and white students attending integrated schools in New Orleans.
And they're speaking specifically of New Orleans. This is
yes.
Lafayette. This
yes.
is miles away from New Orleans. Each parish had its own issues. And they were separately. They are separate in how they were, how politically they were treated.
Mm-hmm.
And my research has led me through Lafayette and several towns around there in which they were late getting education. And
well,
that's not unusual at
right.
all.
Right, that is not unusual because we'll find. Places like St. Helena Parish and Livingston Parish, they all had something unique to that particular parish.
That's right.
And how education was treated throughout the entire state.
And you must also remember, the listeners must also remember, in my mind, through my research, that Louisiana has always been divided racially. So it's no surprise to people who were born and raised in Louisiana during Reconstruction, that there was somewhat of an integrated period,
mm-hmm.
because no one knew who anyone was at that time. Louisiana was so mixed, diverse until you didn't know who was who. So it's not strange to anyone who is from that those generations how it was. Black-skinned people in coming off of these plantations were not treated the same. And that's a bone of contention. It's also an insult. It's also something that we don't discuss very often. And when we write these theories and these ideas and these research papers, I'm talking about my family. And what that means is what I'm referring to are the things that I've discovered in my family.
Mm-hmm.
So each person who does a report, a thesis, or so on, will find something different, or they may see something different. There was a lady that, let's see if I can put my hands on that right now. There was a lady who did her thesis on Lafayette. I was talking to her, it was ironic. I was having a conversation with her at work. She just happened to be a consultant where I was working at the time. And I was mentioning to her that I was researching my great-grandfather in Lafayette. And she said, what was his name? And I told her. She said, you know, I worked in Lafayette for a while. Her name was Dr. Loretta Butler.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I worked in Lafayette for a while, and I do believe I mentioned your great-grandfather in my thesis. And I did get a copy. She brought me a copy of the thesis, and in fact, she did. And pretty much she said the same thing I've just said. It was only a paragraph or so, but she basically said the same thing, how the lack of education that was going on and how these two brothers had been the first to bring education into the area.
And they were indeed extremely brave.
And they would come in
to make a difference. Well, we just have a few more minutes left, but I would like you to share with the audience what unique strategies would you recommend for them to find out more about education of their ancestors,
mm-hmm.
what was happening, and the basic genealogy strategies
mm-hmm.
that have worked for you that may work for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I can really say, first and foremost, is you have to have a real interest in who you are and where your people came from. The town, the city, the place, the churches, the schools, the recreational facilities, whether they be the church, your backyard, wherever, all of the things that pertain to where you lived are crucial and important. There's, in my opinion, there's no stone that should be left unturned when you're talking about the history of your people.
Mm-hmm.
If they were educated, if they were uneducated, in order for us to move on, or the fact that we've moved as far as we have, is because the people before us made it possible for us to come. Poor, middle income, whatever they were, picking cotton, whatever they did, they always made a way for their children to get educated. In the past, even, men, black men, forfeited their education so their sisters could be educated.
Mm-hmm.
Because women could be school teachers. Women could get an education faster than many of the men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're talking the South, and we're talking areas. So when this part of the history is very little is known to our kids today. And I'm not quite sure how we want to tell the stories, but I think all the stories are not going to be wonderful, and my family member was a great person who did these wonderful things. Our people were ordinary people who did great things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How can we convey that message to children today about education and what that value is and what it means as far as freedom? I mean, how can we get that across to them?
Well, the only way I see it and what I've had success, I'm not a school teacher, but the success that I've had in volunteering in some of the schools is just to put the mindset, just to talk to children in a kind and gentle way and let them know that there's pride in who you are and where you came from, no matter where it is.
Mm-hmm.
I've spoken at schools where I've had some teachers were slightly embarrassed by the fact that children didn't respond as they thought they should. And my response to that was, let this child respond the way they know how.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you'll find out what this child is thinking and where the child needs to go with this thought process.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and where you need to go to just talk to the child. You know, I think it's going to be difficult, but we've done it all along. I mean, we've been doing it the best we knew how.
Mm-hmm.
We just have more people now and more education to give. And we have to depend on our communities and ourselves to portray this information to the children. I think the schools are doing the best that they can to educate the kids to live in the society. But I think it's up to us to educate the children to be proud of who they are and make that difference when they go into the school, because they're confident and they know who they are, and they haven't been put down. They've been built up when they enter the school system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
But we clearly have a crisis in education.
Absolutely.
When we're talking about, you know, when we hear a potential candidate say, the first thing that I would do would be eliminate education, Department of Education.
Well, that's kind of the, I don't want to say ignorance, but that's the kind of brainwashing people don't need. And if that's the kind of talk that we're having to listen to, I suggest we turn off the TV, because it doesn't fit in our program for the education and future of children of all races in this country,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And particularly African-American children. Also, these children need something to do to build their mindset, to make them interested in learning about building America.
Absolutely.
Americans.
Well, Beverly, we have a comment coming out of the chat room, and it says, check out The Education of Blacks in the South from 1860 to 1935 by James D. Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
They have an interesting chapter on the establishment of education in Louisiana prior to the Freedmen Bureau taking over the pre-Reconstruction school system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just coming out of the chat. But what I want to do, I want to thank you, Beverly. We're getting ready to wrap up the call.
Okay.
And please join me and my guest, Mark Early, the superintendent of the National Homestead Monument in Beatrice, Nebraska, for a discussion of the 150th anniversary of the Homestead Act of 1862. Are you one of the 93,000 descendants of homesteaders? Have you found land records of your ancestors? This show will focus on the significance of the Homestead Act and the impact it had on land ownership in the United States. You know, when we talked about freedom and education, another thing the freedmen wanted was land. They wanted that 40 acres and a few. So please join me next week. Beverly, thank you very much. Good night. Remember, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives, and beyond. Thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday.
Thank you.
Thank you.